From right to work in Michigan to same-day voter registration in Wisconsin to concealed carry in Illinois, to the fiscal cliff to Wisconsin's poor economic outlook from Forbes magazine. We'll cover these stories and more in this week's edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on this Friday, December 14th. Every Friday, we have two guests join us from different political viewpoints to discuss the top issues in the news each week. And we invite you to weigh in with your questions and your viewpoints, too. And we invite you to introduce the issues that you would like us to discuss at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Today, we welcome in Dan Kopanky, former Republican state senator from La Crosse and owner of the La Crosse Loggers baseball team. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for having me on again.
Thank you very much for joining us. Also joining us is Louis Fortas. He's a former Democratic state lawmaker from Milwaukee. He is the editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express. Good morning.
Morning, Joy, and good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Louis. How are you?
Good.
Well, you know, we started this week with the season's first significant snowfall of the year, at least for most of the state. Western Wisconsin got the brunt of it, about 15 inches or so in the Eau Claire area. I think Dan Kopanky, La Crosse got about 7 inches or so. Are you all dug out now?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's actually, we had about 5 to 6, and we've had some warm weather since, and a lot of it is melting on the south sides. There's no snow. It's all gone already.
Wow, it doesn't take long. And nothing for Milwaukee, Louis.
Well, we've read about what happened.
you're breaking
records.
We saw it
on television. Yeah. We saw it on television.
Longest snowless streak on record for Milwaukee. So are you're hoping to get snow soon?
Some are.
You're not. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about how things really heated up in Michigan this week when the state legislature on Tuesday finalized bills making Michigan a right-to-work state. No longer can public or private unions get mandatory union dues from workers. Governor Rick Snyder, who had said previously that right to work was not on his agenda, signed the legislation into law on Tuesday, right after it was passed, making Michigan the 24th right to work state in the union. Lots of protests took place from union workers and their supporters, but to no avail. Let me ask you first, Dan Kopanky, did Michigan do the right thing?
Well, you know, they looked at the results of a referendum that failed to ban right to work in November, and they actually had more no votes to that than had voted for the president. And so I think that kind of gave them the impetus to do this. Also, the governor looked to his south, Indiana, and saw how they had been right to work for almost a year now. And they have grown over 43,000 jobs where Michigan was losing jobs. And so I think those two factors played into them going ahead with the right-to-work legislation.
Yeah. So is this going to be a good move for Michigan, Louis?
Well, first of all, most business people were not interested and not clamoring for and not asking for any kind of right-to-work laws. And I think what most, enlightened, if you want to call it, or whatever, or self-interested business owners understand that labor peace and a solid workforce is real important, and that's without that, it's pretty tough to do business. And so, I think that if you look at what goes on with right to work, and I remember when I was in graduate school and we study things like this, that students were from all over the country, and when you mentioned right to work, it was kind of, people would smile. I mean, that's fine for kind of low-wage, low-education states, oftentimes in the South. But, the Midwest, the New England, where I went to school, they were looking for educated workforces, and they understood that you need an educated workforce in order to get the higher-paying jobs. So I think what you're doing is bottom-fishing here, and I don't think it's going to work. and I don't think the business community was asking for it, and so I'm not sure what will happen.
Yeah.
If I could follow up, Joy.
Go ahead.
You know, I think, again, I think this comes down, first off, to a matter of freedom. If I'm forced to give dues to an organization, don't I at least have a say as to how this money's spent? And maybe I'm not in agreement as to, you know, the majority and how it is spent. And again, if you look at the 24 states that have right to work, overall, their unemployment is lower than the states that have right to work. And the second thing is, do not have. And the second thing is, in Michigan, where they have this great labor force, automobile history, many of the automakers have not been setting up shop in Michigan. And so, again, the governor and the legislature looked at this and decided that right to work was one way to hopefully improve the jobs. And again, looking at Indiana and the other states that have right to work, when we look at individual states like Wisconsin and all of the other 49, it comes down to a matter of growing jobs and growing our economy to get us out of the financial woes that individual states are in, and we as a nation as well. So, again, this is one way of doing it. It's working in other states. It hasn't been repealed, to my knowledge, in any of those states. So I think there's room for the labor and the workforce and the employers to work together to provide the jobs that are best suited for the region.
Yeah, a quick react, Lewis, to that. This is going to be better for jobs for Michigan or states that adopt a right to work.
Okay, first of all, the auto industry is expanding in Michigan. Secondly, it's always been such, and I don't know what studies Dan is looking at, but the states that do not have right-to-work laws are oftentimes, again, the better-educated states, the higher-income states, and the lower-unemployment states. So, and third, this idea of choice, and I think Dan, and he wasn't real specific here, and he can clarify if I'm wrong, but, I mean, this idea that you've heard this argument that, you know, I may be a Republican and I'm, you know, forced to join the union and my money is, part of my money is being spent to support Democrats. Well, I mean, if I own stock in a corporation today and I don't get to decide, and this corporation is funding money to a particular candidate, I, as a stockholder and owner of a company, I don't have the right to... they don't give me the choice to say, you know, okay, I want you to put, you know, if you're going to spend $1 million on this campaign, I want you to spend my little fraction on this candidate rather than that one. That decision doesn't go to the shareholders. So I think the argument, and I'm not saying, I think Dan alluded to it, and that is this idea of some kind of choice that if you're going to be putting money into the union, you should determine where, you know, how they're using it politically. Well, the same thing with a corporation. Neither one gets to, neither the union members or the, you know, individually or the individual shareholders get to decide.
Yeah.
Well,
let me jump in. Yeah. Let me also jump in though, because we have so much to talk about. Maybe you can weave it into this.
Sure.
Governor Walker says no to right to work in Wisconsin right now. He says it would be too distracting to do the same thing in Wisconsin, even though Governor Walker, as a state legislator, you know, was the author of right to work legislation. So it would be too distracting, the governor says, Dan Kopanky, to do it here. Do you agree?
Well, first off, to Lois's comment there, you can always sell the stock if you don't agree with what the corporation is doing, but it's not so easy to change jobs in this economy. So that's quite a stark difference. The governor has to make decisions that are best for the state as well as the legislature, and if he's not up for a right-to-work battle, much like we went through in 2011, then concentrate on jobs, more power to him. Let's grow jobs in the state of Wisconsin, and let's be very, very competitive with states that are right-to-work or are not right-to-work. It doesn't matter. Let's sell Wisconsin for what it is, and it's a beautiful state to do business, and it's a beautiful state to live and raise a family in.
Yeah, do you believe Governor Walker when he says no to right to work? It would be too distracting, Lewis?
I think it's a lot more complicated right now. Walker is up for re-election in less than 2 years. And he looks at the fact that, depending on what surveys you look at, about a third of the members of unions are actually vote Republican. Walker, in his recall election, which he won by five or six or seven points or whatever. 16 or 17% of the people that were surveyed in the exit interview said, you know, they voted for Walker on this issue because they don't like recalls, but at the same time they were going to vote for Obama. And if you look at, you know, the results in November, people, you know, Obama won overwhelmingly. So what Walker's looking at is the fact that he made this promise of 250,000 jobs. He's produced somewhere around 26,000 jobs. So he has about 90% of the way to go. And the right now, you know, he's saying, you know, this isn't the time or whatever. I think the concern is this, that 2 years from now, exactly 2 years from now, one thing is he's either going to have won or lost re-election as governor. If he's lost re-election for governor, he has nothing to lose, so he probably will support some kind of right to work just because he'll be angry that he lost. If he wins, I mean, what he really has his eye on is national office. And for that, he has to win he has to win the Republican primaries, and the right to work is very, very attractive to the extreme right-wing Tea Party crowd that seems to be driving a significant part of the Republican Party right now. So I think he's absolutely correct. He's not going to do anything until after the November 14 election, and then I wouldn't bet on anything right now.
Well, interesting. The unions are promising political payback to the Republican governors in particular who are pushing these, as they call it, anti-worker agendas. And I'm wondering, Dan Kopanky, if you think these Republican governors have something to fear from the unions.
Well, certainly they're going to be listening to them, but I think Lewis is right in that a lot of people do not like the recalls. And so I think that that'll work in the governor's favor in Michigan as well as it did in Wisconsin, as Lewis pointed out so correctly. I do believe that, again, we need to move forward here in Wisconsin and other states in growing jobs, and it would be a distraction. And I think the scenario that Lewis pointed out is probably, you know, pretty close to maybe right on.
All right. Let me take a couple of calls. Will in DeForest is with us first. Hello, Will.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. Interesting subject. I think people have always had the right to work, and what this legislation is about is not to give freedom to people to work. They've always had that freedom to work. What this is about is taking the country back to the times pre-union, because the people enjoy the fruits of labor of unions, even though they are not forced to join it. So this is all something in taking us back. It's not moving us forward.
Yeah. All right. So Dan Kopanky, he thinks this is bringing us back to pre-union days when wages weren't so great and conditions weren't so great.
Well, the union movement certainly has died off since those days that he's alluding to. I mean, in the private sector right now, there's less than 7% of the workforce is unionized, less than 7%. So it's really not a real big factor in the private sector. It's a bigger factor in the public sector, to be honest. And it is about freedom. I mean, if I want to go work for a company and they have an opening, I'm forced to join a union, really, when I went and take my dues and spend it as they wish.
You're forced to pay the dues, not necessarily join the union, but the dues that would represent you in collective bargaining.
Exactly.
But so what's wrong with having to pay dues to have a union represent you in collective bargaining?
Well, maybe I'm such that I feel that I don't need the union. I mean, 93% of the employees, again, throughout the country are not unionized. They seem to be, you know, that's their choice, and that's what they're doing. Now, some would rather be unionized, but they haven't got the votes to do it. So, again, it's all about growing our economy, and we can work together doing this with the unions and growing our economy. We're trying to do it in Wisconsin. The governor's trying to do it. The legislature's trying to do it. All the states are trying to do it, but, again, it's a distraction, sure. That Walker says this is the governor says this would be a distraction, and I agree with him. We have to focus on the job growth.
Yeah. So if I'm just trying to understand how stopping making a state a right to work state is going to grow the economy. What is it about if only 7% of the workforce are in unions anyway?
Well, look, again, let's look at Michigan and compare it to Indiana, where they went right to work. Indiana did about a year ago, and they've grown 43,000 jobs plus since that time. And Michigan has lost over 7,000 jobs in that same period of time. There's something there.
What is causing that, Louis Fortas?
I don't know, and I get real nervous when you see something happen and you pick one variable and you say, that occurred, and therefore, that's what caused the job thing. I don't know, and I'm sure there are econometricians that have done econometric studies on this to find out what the determining variables were, but I don't know. But I get real nervous when you say, well, you have these two states, and this occurred in one, and that didn't occur in the other, and the unemployment rate went up or down in the other. Therefore, it has to be causal. I don't necessarily buy that at all.
Let me stop. Let's go to Mike in Madison, who's been waiting. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I want to thank you, Joy, for pointing out that nobody is forced to join a union. It's against federal law to require that. Under the Beck ruling in 1988, nobody is forced to join a union to get a job. That's one of the myths that the right to work people always press.
Right, but you have to pay the dues.
Right, but what Beck did was it said that you have to pay an agency fee. And what Mr. Kopanky doesn't tell you is that unions are required by federal law to represent the workers at a workplace, whether they're union or not. So if you take away their financial power or their financial ability to represent workers, whether they're union or non-union, they're not going to be represented.
Yeah, let me ask Dan Kopanky, is this really just what critics say, a moves to weaken unions because Republicans think, that the unions are helping Democratic candidates?
I think in some states, like Indiana, it's probably, and I'm just speculating here, an effort to improve the business climate so that they can grow jobs. That's what's we're in fierce competition with our neighboring states and with all the states in the union to grow jobs so we can balance our budget and provide services to the people that we want to provide, whether it be education or highways or whatever. And so we are in competition, and Indiana and Michigan, their legislature, their leaders, they determined that they would go right to work in an effort to hopefully improve the business climate and grow jobs in their respective states.
There was also in the news this week, a Forbes magazine released its list of the best and worst states to do business. Wisconsin came in at number 42, as in one of the 10 worst states. Forbes says job growth has been middling at best, and it's projected to be the second worst in the United States through 2016. So, Louis Fortas, that doesn't sound like Wisconsin is doing very well or that Wisconsin is open for business, does it?
No, I mean, it goes back to some pretty basic things that, Dan owns a business, I own a business. And I think we both understand that you need a solid workforce because they are your employees are the people that make the business work. And if you have a well-educated, stable workforce with a good attitude toward work and a good feelings toward, the whole that they're getting a fair shake in the game, then I think you have a very good chance to succeed. If you're going to be in a situation where you're bottom fishing, for lack of a better way of saying it, you're fighting for the lowest paid jobs, the less skilled jobs. People may be there may be a few more jobs that you're going to pick up, but you're also not going to be focusing on the important jobs, the jobs that are going to drive the economy, the jobs where you are being innovative in that. The others are going to be more assembly or assembling jobs in that. Not that you know every job is an important job. Don't get me wrong. But if you're going to grow an economy on the long term, you need to have an educated, strong workforce, and you need people who are innovative and people who will, go off and start setting up their own businesses. I mean, that's how you grow an economy.
Yeah, so Dan Kopanky, briefly, because we do need to move on,
sure.
What is it that Wisconsin needs to do to improve that outlook?
Well, I think we're on, without question, we're on the right path, but we have to you know, recover from years of having a reputation of being very tough to do business with, rules and regulations, working with various agencies in the state, high taxes. We had an exodus of businesses out of Wisconsin because of this, and now we're trying to reverse that trend. And also, there's an effort to become more consumer-friendly, if you will, from the state government, from the respective secretaries of the departments. They've been out in the state. They're going out in the state. They're holding forums whereby the individual businesses and residents can ask questions directly of these people and get answers and get a response. And what I've seen is what I see in the private sector, and that is, if you want to stay in business, you better be responsive to your customers. And that's what I see. But it's going to take a while to turn this around. And it was alluded to earlier, the 250,000 jobs. You know, that's a big number, and hopefully we'll be able to get that done for a lot of reasons.
Dan Kopanky, former Republican state senator from La Crosse, and Louis Fortas, editor in chief of the Shepherd Express, are two guests for this edition of the Week in Review. We are going to move on to some other issues, including Susan Rice withdrawing her name from the Secretary of State consideration. That could cause some musical chairs in the U.S. Senate. What do we think about whether or not John Kerry might be the next Secretary of State? And then who replaces John Kerry? And then Herb Kohl bids farewell to the U.S. Senate, and more news on the fiscal cliff. And whatever else you want to talk about, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after four this afternoon, it's your views on the news. You can call in to talk about what you think was the week's most significant news story during your views on the news during At Issue with Ben Marins after 4 every Friday. This is our Friday Week in Review. We have with us two guests from different perspectives talking with you about the top state, national, and international news of the week. Today our guests are Louis Fortas and Dan Kopanky. And let's talk about U.S. Ambassador Susan Rice withdrawing her name from consideration for Secretary of State. Rice has been under heavy pressure by Republicans to withdraw since the attacks in Benghazi. Her withdrawal opens the door for Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, who also chairs the Foreign Relations Committee. Did Susan Rice, Louis Fortas, do the right thing? She thought that it was going to be a very tough confirmation process and didn't want to, I guess, be a distraction there. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it was going to be a real messy fight to get her confirmed. I don't think that's fair to her, that be the reasons, but nonetheless, it was going to be a very messy fight. And I think she either decided that, do I really want to go through all this, and if I lose or whatever, and how much damage will I do to the president? At the same time, I can keep my current job and continue, and she does not have a bad job, let me tell you. So anyway, I think that she probably made the right decision. I think there's some real interesting things when you look at what was going on. You had John McCain, you had Lindsey Graham, and you had Susan Collins, and they were all essentially, you know, saying the same thing. It was like they were reading the same script, and so why should they care whether it's Rice or Kerry or whatever? And I think the fact of the matter is Scott Brown, who was a senator, a Republican senator from a very Democratic state, Massachusetts, was capable of doing quite well in the polls. He lost his reelection, but again, Massachusetts is a very Democratic state, and he was about the best they could hope for in Massachusetts. So if Rice, if you knock out Rice, Kerry, who's been angling for this for years, and who's a buddy of McCain, Kerry would be in a situation, if he gets the appointment, then you have an open seat in Senate seat in Massachusetts, and Brown would have a chance. I assume the governor appoints at least initially, but there would be, you know, an election sometime soon, I would think, to fill that in next cycle. and Scott Brown would have a chance to return to the Senate. I mean, that's about the best that makes sense in terms of making sense, because this whole argument of Benghazi and all that stuff is a joke. I mean, she went up there, she used the information that the CIA provided her, and, you know, is she supposed to be saying, well, this is what the CIA says, but I think it's different? Or, you know, my gut tells me one thing, or I believe it. You know, I mean, you basically, we're paying the CIA a ton of money to be doing the intelligence. At least we should be taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Is that the way you read it, Dan Kopinski?
Well, I agree with most of what Lois has said, and that is, you know, it's probably the right thing to do. It would have been a huge fight, I believe, to get her confirmed, and John Kerry will be a no-brainer. So it's going to go pretty smoothly, and I'm, you know, it depends on, again, Scott Brown, if he's strong enough to win that seat back. I guess time will tell that, but that's the way I see it as well.
Well, let's.
Dan, is it an appointment from the governor initially, or how is the Senate seat filled?
You know, that's a good question. I believe every state is different. Some are able to appoint, and some there'll be a special election. I would assume that he would appoint, or the governor would appoint, until, as you say, the next, when Kerry's term is up, and I'm not sure when that is.
Well, Bill Martins, my producer-director, looked it up, and the governor does appoint someone until a special election is held sometime later. So,
yep. Okay.
There we go. And let's talk about, since we're in the U.S. Senate, talking about the U.S. Senate, let's talk about Wisconsin U.S. Senator Herb Kohl bidding farewell yesterday on the Senate floor. Let's take a listen.
Thank you for letting me pay back in part the great debt my family owes to the state that took in my immigrant mother and father and allowed our family to grow and thrive.
You want to say a few words about Senator Herb Kohl, Louis Fortas?
Well, first of all, if you want to talk about job creation, that family certainly did their fair share.
You got it.
No question about that. Looking at any Republican or Democratic senator or candidate, I can't think of many who have had as charmed a political career as Herb Kohl. He was popular from the beginning, and his popularity never seemed to waver much. And I thought he voted as a solid, progressive Democrat, at the same time when others would be attacked, and that he just seemed to weather every vote very easily and never had a tough re-election. It's people dream of jobs like that.
Yeah, of course, he decided to retire, not run again, and we have a Democratic Congresswoman, Senator-elect Tammy Baldwin, replacing him next year. Your thoughts, Dan Kopinski, on Herb Kohl?
Well, that clip you just played really illustrated that he's a very humble man and obviously very successful man. I wish his Milwaukee Bucks would do a little bit better, and I hope they fill that arena one of these days, Lewis, down there. But
rebuild it. Yeah.
I know it. But, you know, again, I guess, Lewis pretty much checked the points about the no re-election campaigns. You know, I mean, he was pretty much unopposed, and that certainly helped as far as his legacy is concerned, as far as his ability to work in Congress and in the Senate without the distractions of huge campaigns.
Well, let's talk some about the fiscal cliff. President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner had another round of talks at the White House yesterday on how to avert the fiscal cliff. No word on any of the details, but apparently movement has been slow lately. Meanwhile, Illinois Senator Dick Durbin said that an increase in the Medicare eligibility age is no longer being considered by the White House, and a growing number of Republicans seem to be open to raising tax rates on top income earners. So let's get your take, Dan Kopinski, first on whether you think Democrats are doing enough with regard to averting the fiscal cliff.
Well, the Republicans have come forward with a plan to eliminate some loopholes and deductions, whereby I think revenue would increase, I might be wrong on this number, but $800 billion, I believe. The president has come out with, he wants more, he wants a tax increase on the top 1 or 2%. And also, they have not discussed, which I think is critical here, enough, how they're going to shrink the size of the U.S. government. Because two things need to happen here. Taxes are not going to correct our deficit. It's going to take, it's only a small part, it's going to take a growth in our economy and also shrinking the size of the federal government. And that has not been discussed enough, in my opinion. I believe that the Republicans in the House should just come forward with a plan where they're going to close these loopholes, and they already have that, but also demand before they sign on to anything that the size of the U.S. government is decreased, and we have created a better climate for job growth, which is really the answer to this issue.
Yeah, Louis Fortas, your thoughts on the fiscal cliff talks?
Well, first of all, I've heard about all these tax loopholes, but I've yet to see anything really specific as to, you know, what loopholes they are going to be specifically closing, the Republicans. Secondly is, you know, elections matter. And I mean, when you run on saying, you know, we want to raise the tax rates on people earning over $250,000. Again, when you talk about that, you're only talking about the income over $250,000. Under that, they get all the same rates that everyone else under $250,000. It's just that the amount of income over $250,000 would be taxed at a higher rate. That's what he ran on. All of the polls that have been taken in the last several couple of months, people, the American public support that by, you know, close to 70%, feeling that, you know, this should be fair, and that people who earn more should be, you know, paying their fair share. So I think that you know, he held that out there. He didn't, you know, President Obama, when he ran, he discussed it continuously. He was very straightforward about that. He said that this, if I get reelected, we're going to do this. And I think the public was, you know, was behind him by, say, about 70%. So I think that will happen. I think there will be some scaling back of obviously of government expenditures, but I think the biggest issue, and this is what, I don't know about your experiences, Dan, but when I used to campaign and I would talk to people at the doors, and their issues were not, you know, that they were anti-government programs. They, like I and you and everyone else, I mean, we just want efficient government. And we want certain things done by government, and, you know, roads and infrastructure, and also taking care of the poor and that. And people just want it done efficiently. So I don't think anyone's opposed to trying to tighten up what we're doing so it's more efficient. But at the same time, revenues are important. We're one of the lowest tax industrialized countries in the world.
Yeah, let me jump in. There was a poll out this week that said that the American public, gosh, like three quarters of them practically, would blame Republicans if we fall off the fiscal cliff. Dan Kopanky, is that going to force Republicans to agree to this tax rate hike for the wealthy?
I'm not sure it will. Again, they've come forward with this plan to cut the loopholes and deductions, which would raise revenue, which is in effect raising taxes. We have not seen, to counter Lewis there a little bit, we have not seen a plan by the president or his administration that will cut the size of the federal government as well. So, I mean, if they come forward with some cuts, I think the Republicans would be more, there would be more incentive for them to do something as far as the revenue is concerned. But right now, 1% of the people pay 40% of the federal income taxes. 1% pay 40%. The question is, how much is enough that we need to answer?
Well, you know, Scott in Sturgeon Bay asks, some of the tax money will cover what's needed to ward off a fiscal cliff, but where will the rest of the money come from, Lewis?
The rest of the money to cover the fiscal cliff that they created? Or what are we talking about in terms of covering right now? Because you don't have a situation like the states do where you have to balance the budget each year. You also are coming out of a recession. You want stimulus. You want to spend more than you're taking in right now because that's how you get the economy going again. That's economics 101. I think that was kind of settled theory a while ago. And And then when the economy is going stronger, that you begin to run some surpluses and begin to bring down the deficits, the debt. I mean, that's kind of how you run a free market economy, is that you intervene at different times in different ways. And so this fiscal cliff is created theoretically either by Congress or basically the 24-hour news stations that need to have something to fill the gap. There was nothing other than the Bush-era tax cuts that expire at the end of this year. That was the only thing that was going to happen. And that could have been, part of it could have been extended. None of it could be extended. All of it could be extended. But that's the only thing that was going to happen until Congress came in and created their own fiscal cliff.
All right, it's time for me to break. This is our Week in Review, talking with Louis Fortas, editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express, and Dan Kopanky, former Republican State Senator of La Crosse and owner of the La Crosse Loggers baseball team. And we will have our Week in Review quiz coming up next. And we have a number of interesting state and national issues still to cover, including Governor Walker backing off his support of ending same-day registration, voter registration in Wisconsin, saying it would be too costly. So we'll talk about those issues and many more on the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's time for our Week in Review quiz question. Here we go. A high-profile figure tweeted for the first time this week to say, "Dear friends, I am pleased to get in touch with you through Twitter. Thank you for your generous response. I bless all of you from my heart." Who is it? Who is this high-profile figure who tweeted for the first time this week? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. If you think you know, you can also email your answer, talk@wpr.org. We will announce the winner and the answer at the end of the show today. The winner will receive one of the books that we've featured on the program recently. One of the books we featured on the program recently, by the way, was Wisconsin's Best Beer Guide. So you might want to guess. This is the Week in Review. Joy Cardine talking with Dan Kopanky and Louis Fortas about the news of the week. A caller's been waiting with an issue that he wanted to bring up, so let's go to Scott in New Glarus. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I'd be interested on the take of your two guests on the possible either doing away with or severely curtailing the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. The Republicans have been using it like, I don't know, kids in a candy store, just at the drop of a hat. What are your thoughts on that?
All right, there was some talk about that this week, too. Louis Fortas, should the filibuster rules be changed?
Well, I think what's happened is that it's been tremendously overused. And this isn't just the Democrats kind of saying this. This is the American Enterprise Institute and people. I think anyone who's looked at it has understood that it's gone over the line and it's no longer designed. It's no longer functioning the way it was initially thought it would function. Instead of slowing things down, it just stops everything unless you have 60 votes. So the only way it can be changed is without having 60 votes is to do it when you're initially passing the rules for the coming 2 years. And that has to be done the first day of session which is usually a perfunctory thing where they just vote to accept the rules going forward. So if they want to change it, they need to change it then. And I think what they will do is they will tinker with it. I don't think it's going to be a massive change, but there has to be some way to enable legislation to move forward without having to have 60 votes for every piece of legislation. I think Mitch McConnell said, last year, very publicly, that his goal was to, a couple years ago, was to deprive Obama of a second term, and they basically stopped everything. And then people are saying, you know, the government doesn't work. Well, things were getting passed in the House, both under the Democrats, under the Republicans now, but different, obviously very different things. But the Senate was the obstacle, and the Senate would have a majority of people supporting something, but they didn't have the 60. So something needs to be done, or else we're going to have a totally dysfunctional government.
Yeah, your quick response, Dan Caprivi?
Yeah, I'll be quick. I don't think it's going to change. Both sides have used it as a last line of defense, really, to stop legislation and get the parties at the table to talk about improving it. So I don't see a change there.
Yeah, let's talk about a lot of state issues and others. Governor Walker said this week he will not sign a bill ending same-day voter registration if it costs taxpayers $5 million plus. That's the figure that was released recently from the Government Accountability Board, said that eliminating election day same-day registration would cost $5.2 million right away and another $1.9 million every 2 years after that due to administrative costs. So governor backing off his support of a bill to end same-day voter registration in Wisconsin. Are you backing off, Dan Kopanky?
Well, if the governor isn't, if there's that kind of a price tag, I can understand why he's doing it. Same-day registration, I have believed for some time, we either have same-day registration with voter ID or we don't have same-day registration. And we did pass a voter ID law that has been hung up in the courts. I think it still is. But I believe that we need one of those two to uphold the integrity of our elections. I'm not as much, I'm more in favor of voter ID than I am of eliminating same-day registration.
Are you relieved to hear the governor say he might not, or he doesn't, he wouldn't sign a bill that costs that much, Louis Fortas?
Well, I think the same-day registration is something that Wisconsin had always been very proud of. We have some of we're the second highest voting state percentage-wise in the nation. It's something that, and we run around the world trying to help developing countries expand democracy. And over the last couple of years, whether it's voter ID or whether it's, you know, talking about eliminating same-day registration, we're moving in the exact opposite direction. And so both of those things are solutions to issues that are not problems. We don't have, they did a big investigation, a Republican U.S. attorney and a district attorney, Democratic district attorney did a big investigation of voter fraud in Milwaukee, and they couldn't find any. So I don't know. Maybe it's in other parts of the state. Maybe it's in, you know, maybe Dan knows more about what's going on in that area. But we don't have voter fraud in Milwaukee.
Let me move on to another issue. Another issue that the governor's office, I guess the governor, withdrew a request that the state pay $478,000 for some remodeling of the governor's mansion's kitchen. I guess Administration Secretary Mike Hipsch says the request will be reintroduced if the private sector effort to raise the money in the private sector comes up short. A quick react to that, Louis.
Well, I think this idea of having this set up in such a way that people that want to have influence with the governor's office can make a simple contribution to beautify the governor's mansion, but trust me, that contribution does not go unnoticed. And I think, as much as, you know, no one wants to have tax dollars paying for things, it's a lot more honest way to do it, to take it out of the state treasury, than to allow people to curry favor by doing something so kind and generous as to improve the mansion.
What about that, Dan Kopanky?
Well, I think you'll have many people step forward and want to donate, whether it's $20 or $20,000. And I think it's, again, better with non-taxpayer dollars than with taxpayer dollars at the time we're in right now, the times.
Yeah. Another story this week kind of got buried in a lot of things. Came from the state of Illinois. An appellate court struck down the Illinois concealed carry law and instructed lawmakers to come up with something that legalized concealed weapons. A quick react to that, Louis Fortas?
Yeah, you have Posner, who is this extreme ideologically right-wing, apparently a smart guy, but also very, very ideologically right-wing appellate judge. And these are the people that have complained about activist judges and all of that. So here they've overruled the laws passed by the elected officials in the state of Illinois. I think there's a bit of hypocrisy going on that one. And it all goes down to how you define how you interpret the Second Amendment, which, you know, I always thought was for militias, not that, you know, people can carry guns into, you know, churches and supermarkets.
Mm-hmm. Dan Kopanky?
Well, Illinois, last state in the union not to have concealed carry, and really the absence of concealed carry hasn't really worked very well for the state of Illinois. If you look at the crime rate and the major crimes that are being committed in Chicago area, seems like on a daily basis. So 49 other states have signed on to concealed carry. Illinois ought to join the crowd.
Yeah. One of our Week in Review regular guests announced this week, Marquette University Law School professor Ed Falone, that he will run for state Supreme Court. We will not be asking Professor Falone to join us on the Week in Review while he's an active candidate, certainly for equal time and fairness reasons. But maybe just a quick handicap, Louis Fortas, of how important this race for state Supreme Court is going to be.
Well, I think it's extraordinarily important. And Pat Rogensack, I supported her initially when she was running for appellate judge in the mid 90s, and began to back off very quickly when I saw that, you know, afterward that she started out as a moderate and she was going to be fair and balanced and all that. And as time went on, she has just fell in line with the ideologues. And the Supreme Court, which is supposed to be our last, you know, chance for a justice, has become highly, highly political, and that's a shame because you want a judge who, you know, you don't care where they are politically as long as they approach things. You know, they keep their politics to themselves, and they actually try to look at what's going on and look at the Constitution, look at the facts, and we don't have that right now in our state Supreme Court, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Briefly on the Supreme Court race coming up, Dan Kopanky?
I don't know this guy, Ed Lone, but I, you know, certainly it's great that he's going to put his name on the ballot. He talks about independent and impartial and fair, and that's what we need. And I've seen Justice Rogensack as being a conservative judge, not an activist judge, and I think that's very good.
Well, let's congratulate Evelyn and Nina. She is our Week in Review quiz winner. She correctly answered that the high-profile figure who tweeted for the first time this week was...
Joy Cardine?
No, it was the Pope. His Holiness sent his first tweet into the world on Wednesday, and it had more than 2,000 retweets in under 2 minutes. The Pontiff's handle is @Pontifex? Anyway, he tweets also in 8 different languages. Wow. So, Louis, I take it, or Dan, are you following the Pope on Twitter?
I am not. I do tweet, and I have Twitter, but I haven't gotten his yet, so I'm not sure. Maybe I'm not connected enough.
You won't do that. All right. Louis, thanks very much. And Dan Kopanky, thanks very much for being with us. Louis Fortas, editor-in-chief of the Shepherd Express, and Dan Kopanky, former Republican state senator from La Crosse. Thanks to Bill Mertens, who was the producer and director of this program. Thanks as well to Rob Ferret and to Cynthia Schuster for production assistance. And thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. Plus, we will be talking about more state news coming up in our state capitol report between 7 and 8 on Monday morning. We hope you join us for the state capitol report every Monday. I'm Joy Cardine. Have a good weekend. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.